Good afternoon. I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. Recent research on aging suggests we are what we think. It turns out that if we harbor negative stereotypes about getting old, that could actually affect our health as we get older. Joining us to talk through the power of negative and positive thinking is Professor Becca Levy. She's a professor at the Yale School of Public Health. Her latest study on aging tracked adults for 30 years, documenting how their perceptions of aging influence their own aging process. Also with me is Dr. Thomas Pearl. He is the director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center. And Professor Mahzarin Banazi joins us from her office at Harvard, where she is the professor of social psychology. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Now, I want to give a call out to our listeners because I know that you have some feelings about aging and stereotyping. So which ones do you harbor? Which stereotypes do you want to challenge? Give us a call at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Dr. Levy, I want to start with you and ask if you would explain what the study found and why did you decide to look at this?
Sure. Thanks, Callie. It's great to be on your program. It's great to be on with Dr. Banaji and Dr. Pearls. So let me tell you, yes, a little bit about this latest study. We've been really interested in the question of, is it possible that the age stereotypes that exist in a culture have a direct impact on the older individuals? And previously, we've been looking at this experimentally and in the community over time, but we've been focusing on older individuals. And we've always assumed that it's the stereotypes are taken in at a younger age, and then they're carried over into old age. But we haven't been able to look at that until this most recent study. And in this study, we were actually able to look at individuals who were 18 to 39 at the beginning of the study, and they were studied in 1968, and they were asked about their beliefs about aging, the stereotypes that they'd taken in from the culture, and then they were followed over the next 40 years. And what we looked at was we looked to see whether there was a relationship between these early expressed age stereotypes and whether or not they had a cardiovascular event, such as a heart attack or a stroke 40 years later. And what we found was that indeed the younger people who expressed more negative age stereotypes were twice as likely to have a cardiovascular event when after their 60th birthday.
That just seems, you know, if you're just listening to it, you think, how could that be? You know, my thought is going to lead me, if I think a bad thing about older people or getting older, that I'm going to end up with a heart attack later on. I mean, what are the particulars? Let's talk about some of the stereotyping. When you say stereotype, what exactly do you mean or what did they mean, your study participants?
Right. Yes. So in different studies, we've looked at stereotypes in different ways. But in this study, so I should say that this is the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging. And so I didn't initially collect the data. This was started by people at the National Institute on Aging in 1968. And they asked people a series of questions about their beliefs about aging. So, for example, a negative stereotype, somebody who would be in the group of negative stereotypes of aging would agree with the item, old people are helpless. So they would think of old people as being more helpless, whereas somebody in the more positive age stereotype group would have an image more like old people are wise or would agree that that sounded more relevant to how they think about aging.
Dr. Banaji, this is your area of expertise, looking at how people come to believe certain things, either really covertly or overtly, I guess is the way to put it. Can you speak to how those of us who are just out here internalize these stereotypes, how we get to them to begin with?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I should just say that Becca Levy's work has sort of breathed life into the more basic demonstrations of age bias that we have been collecting data on for many years now. And what we're interested in, and age is sort of one example of this, is a fundamental difference between what we consciously say we believe, and this could be a true statement. So we're not talking here about people who might be deceiving others by saying, oh, I think I'm going to say to you I like the elderly even though I secretly harbor negative feelings. No, we are actually quite honestly saying, look, we have reasonably favorable feelings towards the elderly. We think they're wise and they're kind, and we know that there might be issues involving health and so on, and that only provokes sympathy. But that's at the conscious end of things. And what we have looked is the other side of this coin. We've looked at what goes on in our brain regarding these beliefs about social groups that could look quite different than what we are able to say consciously. And when we do that, when we look at something simple, like how quickly can you associate wonderful things, words like love and peace and joy and friendship and so on, with young people versus elderly, and how quickly can we associate negative things, words like devil and bomb and vomit and things like that, with young and elderly, we discover that 80% of the sample of people who we have studied, and there are hundreds of thousands of these people, show a strong young preference, and that only about 6% in the sample show a reverse preference of favoring the elderly on these implicit measures. And we see this in both men and women. We see this in all ethnic groups. We see it in all regions of the country. And interestingly, we see it in people who are politically both on the left and the right.
Okay. I want to give our listeners a little, before I get to Dr. Thomas Pearl, an idea of what we mean about some of the sort of stereotyping that's out in the public, if you will, for us to internalize. And here's a television commercial that a lot of people are familiar with. It became popular for the medical device Life Alert, which perpetuated one of the most famous catchphrases that we have come to associate with old age.
I've fallen and I can't get up.
So there you have it, Dr. Pearl. That's something that everybody says, and it's only meant in a negative way. Nobody's using that phrase to indicate anything youthful, right?
That's right. And, of course, that particular one that you just aired is certainly part of all kinds of very unfortunate jokes we've heard. I think the finding that Becca, Dr. Levy, has produced in the literature now, showing a increase by twice of the risk for heart attack and cardiovascular disease generally, is phenomenal. And relating it to our own work in the centenarian study, what we've looked at is personalities among the centenarians as well as their kids. And the kids, of course, are in their 70s and early 80s.
okay.
And I wonder if part of the finding here relates to personality and whether one is optimistic or not. The kids scored incredibly low in one domain of personality testing, being neuroticism. And what this means is that they don't dwell on things. They don't internalize things. They tend to be humorous and optimistic, and it probably translates into a phenomenal ability to manage their stress very well. And
would it also mean that they would just, sort of flick off those kinds of internalized stereotypes that some other people are taking with them?
Or that that they just don't have those stereotypes because they have a very optimistic view. And the other thing that they scored quite high in is extroversion, meaning that they're very apt to have social relationships, both intergenerationally, and that probably translates into the ability to establish some pretty important social networks that are important in case you need help, but also are very cognitive stimulating, which may have some benefit as well. I think that this optimistic view is very, very important. And the question is what is it a marker of? What is happening at a physiological basis, which is kind of the question you opened the show with, that would actually translate into a decrease by half in your cardiovascular risk?
And the word stress is used in the study, Dr. Levy, all of you doctors. And as we know, stress can be what you can't handle, right? That's what the doctors tell me, is that, you can be in a lot of quote-unquote stressful situations, but if you can manage it either by lifestyle or by mental fitness, then it doesn't affect you in the same way it may affect some other people who cannot manage it. Is that what you've seen with your centenarians, Dr. Pearl?
Very much. It's not the amount of stress. A lot of these individuals have had huge amounts of stress. It's how you manage it that seems so very key. And along the same lines, another thing that we have found is a stereotype that you often hear from the medical side with older people is the older you get, the sicker you get. And we have found with the centenarians and their kids that they not only age very slowly, but they also compress the disability towards the very end of their lives. So it becomes a very optimistic scenario for these people who age well. And instead of the older you get, the sicker you get, what we see is the older you get, the healthier you've been.
Dr. Banaji, what Dr. Levy's study has said is that younger people start getting these stereotypes and then it impacts them, 38 years later or whatever. Can you tell from your work when it is that we begin to have these stereotypes as a part of our being? When do we start thinking of old people as ancient, if you will, sort of not a natural process of sort of maturation, so to speak, but something other than that?
Yes, I would say that, although I won't give you a specific age, I can say that it's very, very early in life that kids begin to notice age as a variable. We have studies with children as young as age 3 where they're beginning to notice what age means. So, for example, a 3-year-old child will pick a food or a piece of clothing or whatever that a younger child picked rather than an older person did, because they know that their preferences are more likely to be like the young child's rather than the older person's. So we know that quite early the differences between different age groups is something that children are quite perceptive about and use in their own decision-making. It's hard to say a precise age at which the negative stuff begins to enter, but I think for our listeners, the important thing is that it's probably happening quite early in life, and that in part this may be happening because of the images that they see, but also because of the things that parents might say, or just because we all use those things. I don't want to be older or anything negative. And I think that this is something that most adults don't recognize, that they are creating in young children through very subtle kinds of things that they do and say. And so they're often surprised when their children say negative things about the elderly, because they can't imagine where they could have picked this up from.
All right. Well, we're going to come back to this because it's a fascinating topic. And, of course, I'm getting younger by the moment. That's how I'm looking at this conversation. I'm Callie Crossley, and we're talking about old age and how our perceptions of aging influence the way we age. We are joined by Dr. Thomas Pearl. He's with the Boston Medical Center. Professor Becca Levy is at the Yale School of Public Health, and Professor Mazarin Banaji is at Harvard. Listeners, call in if you would. Give us your thoughts about getting older. Who are your role models? We're at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from the Boston Herald and bostonherald.com. Comprehensive reporting and analysis of local and national news, business, sports, lifestyle, and much more. The Boston Herald. Somebody's got to say it. And from the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, the 3rd Annual Lowell Film Festival showcases films from Hollywood's golden age of the 1930s. Charlie Chaplin, Betty Davis, and more, April 8th through the 10th. Cultureiscool.org.
Sweet or dry, red or white, the WGBH Wine Auction has it all. Bid on fine wines to add to your collection, to start a new collection, or just to serve at your next dinner party. Bidding stops March 30th. Support WGBH and bid on some fine wine at the same time, securely online at auction.wgbh.org. Sponsored by Skinner Auctioneers and Appraisers.
You're listening to 89.7 WGBH,
Boston's NPR station for news, context, and analysis.
With Morning Edition,
The Takeaway,
and The Diane Rehm Show.
Explore ideas with us
all day long
here on the new 89.7 WGBH.
Celebrate the birthday of Broadway legend Stephen Sondheim with a round trip for two aboard Amtrak's Acela Express to catch Sondheim at 80, live in Washington, D.C. Rules and entry online at WGBH.org.
I'm I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about getting older and how our perception of what it means to be old can influence how we age. We are joined by Dr. Becca Levy. She's a professor at the Yale School of Public Health. We are also joined by Dr. Thomas Pearls, as in a string of pearls. He is the director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center. And Professor Mahzarin Banaji is a professor of social psychology at Harvard University. How do you think about getting older, listeners? What comes to mind when you have a picture of someone getting old? I wanted to share with my guests something that I saw in the New York Times. This is really interesting. I don't know if all of you saw it. It's a story about it's called Honoring a Long Life, but she's just 30 plus 71. And it's a story about a woman from Barbados who's turning 101 but refuses to accept that she's 101. In Barbados, they have a ritual which pays attention to and shows expression for those people who are 100 or more. But she is someone who has been living in the United States, and she wants nobody to know how old she is. So here's just a piece of the story. It says, Mae Bishop is 101. According to her birth certificate, she will turn 102 on May 16th. But with the feistiness and independence that have characterized her long life, she has steadfastly refused to acknowledge that she has lived a century. This piece is by Kirk Semple in the New York Times. This does not surprise you, Dr. Pearls, or maybe it does. Your centenarians are happy to be 100.
Yeah, it makes one think if she's been deluged with these negative stereotypes we've been talking about. I would say that many of our centenarians and their families are extremely proud of this milestone. If you think that's something, you should see somebody who turns 110. That turns out to be quite the party. But, you know, you had mentioned that down there they have a celebration for older people like that. They do that in Okinawa, Japan as well, where if you turn 97, there's a huge parade and celebration for these individuals. And I think that these societies that celebrate these very, very old ages are healthier. And it really points to Dr. Levy's research.
Dr. Levy, do you have any studies that indicate in these other societies where people are celebrating the centenarians and aging in a positive way that they don't get the kind of cardiovascular disease that you saw in your study participants?
Oh, yes, we have done some cross-cultural work, and we have found that in China, for example, where more positive stereotypes were expressed, that the older individuals there had an advantage on a number of memory tasks, so they had better memory performance than people in other cultures that had more negative stereotypes. And also within cultures, you see a big difference between people who are in sort of subcultures that support positive stereotypes of aging and those that have less positive stereotypes.
Okay, we have several callers. Let me go to Nola from Acton, Massachusetts. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm just wondering how much your studies may have looked into the role of grandparents in the community in which you grew up. I would say I grew up in a small town in western New York, and so I had a variety of images of older people in the community and church and my own grandparents.
Positive images, right?
Well, diverse images,
okay.
I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It was more to say, okay, some people are sort of infirm and can't get around very well and are housebound when they're older, and others are active, and so it's not necessarily one or the other, you know. I don't remember negative images particularly in childhood, although when people have said to me, oh, your mother lived to a long age, you probably will, I have long said, yes, but my mother didn't worry about things that she couldn't control, and I don't have that gift.
Mm. Dr. Levy, do you want to respond to this?
Well, yes, I think that the families and that people are grow up in and positive role models have a big impact on the kind of stereotypes that people grow up with. And I think also what the caller just mentioned about a diversity of images, I think that that is probably a great skill or a great resource to have as somebody gets older to draw on a number of different types of images. So I believe that those are both things that are very likely to have very good impacts, good prognosis going forward.
Thank you very much, caller.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have another caller, Leanne from Framingham. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I had a question about how you handled the possible confounder of family history, in that somebody may have a particular impression of what happens in old age because their parents have cardiovascular disease and age early, and you know, that obviously would influence their opinion and also influence their risk of developing those early aging problems.
I'm going to let Dr. Pearls speak to that a little bit, because with your centenarian work, you have developed a test. By the way, you can go to our Facebook page and see it. It's called livingto100.com. It's a calculator, an age calculator, which addresses some of the issues that the caller just raised, right?
A very astute caller, because we worry about that kind of confounding all the time, and we for sure need to go back to Dr. Levy to find out how she handled that. I would say that we know that aging, about 30% of it is genetic, and the 70% is environmental. That's to get to, I would say, one's late 80s, which is what we're all aiming for here, I think, in this conversation, in that there's a number of studies showing that if you have the right health-related behaviors, not smoking, regular exercise, being at a healthy weight, managing your stress well, so on and so forth, that probably spending a lot of time with family, perhaps even religion, that also translates into managing stress for at least the Seventh-day Adventists, who have an average life expectancy of 88 years. And with that, they seem to delay their disability towards the end of their lives. And if they are experiencing cardiovascular disease, it's not until quite late. With the centenarians and even older individuals, 105, 110, we're seeing a really important increased role for familiality, which is what the caller is getting to. And don't forget that familiality.
That's people in your family. People in your family.
Yeah, familiality isn't just genes. We have a lot of things in common in families, whether it be smoking or not smoking, dietary habits, years of education, socioeconomic status, that really impact upon life expectancy. I would guess, though, that about 30% of getting to really, really old age is still going to be a strong genetic component, but this confounding issue is really important, as things really do run very strongly in some particular families that can be really quite remarkable for the penetration of extreme longevity.
So, Dr. Levy, what do you say about that genetic component?
Yes, yeah, so that's a great question that the caller had, and as Dr. Pearls points out, there is a lot of genetic components of longevity. In our study, fortunately, we did have a measure of familial patterns of cardiovascular disease, so we were able to adjust for that. So actually, the caller's question was asked by a reviewer when we first wrote up this paper, and we went back to the data set, and we were very excited to find that the original investigators had included a question about family history of cardiovascular disease. So in our study, we were able to look whether above and beyond cardiovascular history in the family, we still see the effects of age stereotypes on individuals' own cardiovascular health.
Wow. That says a lot, I think. I want to, speaking of these stereotypes, give our listeners just another listen to how stereotypes are perpetuated just casually in our society. And here's comedian Joe DeVito perpetuating a prominent old age stereotype.
Where I live on Long Island, I'm about 2 miles from the highway entrance, and it was always nice, it was convenient. They opened a retirement community in between, so now it takes me about 2.5 hours to get to the highway. The way these people, don't you think you would drive a little faster if you could feel the cold hand of death on your shoulder? Don't you think you might floor it knowing that the hour was nigh, that you...
Dr. Banaji, what kind of impact does that have? You know, this is, you know, you can hear everybody laughing, and you know, I don't think anybody thinks about it. They just accept that as reality.
That's the remarkable thing about age stereotypes. I mean, imagine if something racial had been said or something sexist had been said. It would not provoke the same kind of reaction at all. And that is one of the intriguing things about age, that if you ask people, they'll probably tell you that even though they don't like it, their race stereotypes are worse than their age stereotypes, they worry about that more. But it turns out, you know, actually age stereotypes are really among the strongest stereotypes in almost any culture. 80% on the implicit stereotypes, on the stuff that we don't consciously know about or can't quite control, 80% of the population shows evidence of some type of anti-elderly bias. That's huge. And yet, it turns out that like certain kinds of biases, this one kind of flies under the radar. We actually don't even worry too much about it. And I think it's for those kinds of biases that we have to be particularly vigilant.
Dr. Pearls wants to get in.
Yeah, I think there's also an extremely pernicious, ugly secondary gain or even primary gain side to these stereotypes. I'm actually a very loud critic of the anti-aging industry, which I really equate to anti-old people. And
when you say anti-aging industry, what do you mean?
This is an industry that isn't just creams. It's saying that they have potions, things like growth hormone or anabolic steroids that stop and reverse aging and make people, quote, young again. And to me, it's virtually all quackery and hucksterism. But the problem is, first and foremost, is that they promote these ageisms. They promote these stereotypes. They promote – this is the picture of old people. They're all sitting in wheelchairs and Johnny's facing nursing home walls. And that's what they want to first do, to scare the heck out of baby boomers. And then out of the next thing they say is, oh, but we can cure this. They treat it as a disease. And it's really a horrible, misleading, awful industry. And so it can have and the result is millions and millions of dollars in the pockets of these hucksters. So there can be really some primary gain behind the promotion of some of these stereotypes. It's not just a thing to be set up on stage by a comedian.
We're talking with Dr. Thomas Pearls, director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Banerjee, who is a professor of social psychology at Harvard University, and Dr. Becca Levy, who just completed a study at Yale. It's the Yale School of Public Health, which is linking how we think about aging with cardiovascular disease down the road if we think negatively about it. Let me ask all of you to maybe respond to this. Is this a form of self-loathing then, Dr. Banerjee? We're all going to get older, so shouldn't we think about that in those terms?
So that again, is a very interesting question, because in general, psychologists find that people like their own groups better. I mean, that's often at the heart of much of the difficulties that we see all around the world, where we like our own and we look at the other and say, that's scary, or that's in some ways not as good. And with age, we actually see a very different pattern. People who are 60 years old or older show the same anti-elderly bias on the unconscious tests that we have as young people do. And so what this means is that more than any other bias that we've looked at, the elderly have themselves, to some extent, internalized these negative views, which is why I think Dr. Pearls' work and Dr. Levy's work is so interesting, because it shows that in the groups of the smaller groups of people who are for some reason not doing this, you see these vast gains in longevity, in good health, and so on. But we have to keep very much in the front of our mind that the elderly themselves have incorporated these into their view of themselves, into their own identity, and so on. Yeah.
Dr. Levy, excuse me, I wonder if you, I don't know how you would do this, but how would you factor in the impact of the baby boomers? Because speaking to Dr. Pearls' whole anti-aging institute, I mean, this cohort has been in the front of anti-aging. They've extended what one thinks about, you know, being a certain age. Which, you know, I'm reminded of all of the kind of advertising that says stuff like, this is not your grandfather's watch, you're as young as you feel, this is what 60 looks like, on and on and on. How, in your study, could you pay attention to that kind of impact, or did you?
Well, I think that there was a lot of hope that the baby boom generation would change these negative stereotypes of aging. But I think because of some of the dynamics that we've been talking about, because these stereotypes are taken in at such a young age and because they're reinforced by television, by all sorts of messages in everyday life, that I think by the time this cohort is turning 60 and 70, that they have had decades and decades of reinforcement of the negative stereotypes. So it's hard to overcome them. But I think it's possible. I should say that I don't think that – I think people do have the skills and resources to overcome them, but I think that we don't yet have the research and all the knowledge of how to do this. But I do think it's possible. So I think that there's some hope in still changing these negative stereotypes.
We have a caller, Dolores from Rhode Island. Go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Age is a matter of mindset in America, but I came from a different era. Old age is like everything else. To make a success of it, you have to start young. Therefore, growing up in Virginia, I was around elderly people all of my life, and I still love old ladies, although I am getting there. But people, it's a mindset. The modern generation has not taken time to learn where they came from. People are so busy chasing their end until they don't learn about their beginning. My grandmother, at 80 years old, my youngest aunt passed away. She had 6 children from the ages of 17 to 4.
Do you want to tell us how old you are?
I don't mind telling you, but I will do it with a riddle.
Okay, well, I'm not very good at riddles, but go ahead.
I will be 29,200 days old on July 21st.
I'm going to let Dr. Pearls figure that out.
Oh, no.
Well, let me say, Dolores, if I may, thank you for your call, that here's what some of the work of Dr. Pearls' Centenarian Project has shown, and I think this emphasizes what you've just said. Few centenarians are obese. In the case of men, they are nearly always lean. Substantial smoking history is rare. Centenarians are better able to handle stress than the majority of people. And most centenarian women, I find this very interesting, have a history of bearing children after the age of 35 years and even 40. So what our caller says is right? It's get your mind ready about it.
It is a mindset. But one thing I'd like to say, my grandmother raised all 6 of those children, and she passed away when she was in 130 year.
And by the way, Dolores, you're almost 80, we figured out.
Yes, I am.
Okay,
and
there you go.
I don't feel, well, people tell me I don't look whatever.
All right, thank you for your call. I'm going to allow Dr. Pearls to respond to you. Go ahead, Dr.
Thank
Pearls.
Well, I think there's 2 things to say is that the older people are a very heterogeneous group. And, we have 50% of people over the age of 85 who are don't have dementia, are cognitively intact. And so on the other hand, we have those who aren't doing so well. And we do find that the very old people will congregate against among those who are doing well, and they may avoid those who aren't doing so well. And I think one develops these stereotypes depending upon what they want to pay attention to and what they want to perseverate about. Dr. Levy had, and I think rightfully so, indicated concern about the stereotypes that baby boomers are making themselves stuck with. But what I am also observing is as they get older, they become offended and they look at themselves and I say, they say, I'm nothing like that.
They do.
And I, for one, actually think that we're seeing much less of these stereotypes in the media that is focused on baby boomers because they're offended and they're saying, that's not me.
Well, that's where my question was going about with the impact of baby boomers, I wondered. But I think Dr. Banaji's point was by the time they get there, they're ready to change. But mm-hmm. leading up to that point, they've been holding these stereotypes. I want to put out that as an African-American woman, I have certain other kinds of stereotypes about aging. And, you know, black don't crack. That's where we come from. So I'm going to look good. Now, I might not be healthy, but I'm going to look good longer. So I have role models, those women and men who you really can't tell their age. I'm reminded of something that Essence Magazine, which is a magazine for African-American women targeted toward them, has every year. And it's really like guess the ages of these women. And mm-hmm. I defy you to guess the ages of the women in the magazine. They look like they're 20. And, you know, so I think it's helpful for me to have those kinds of role models because I'm telling you, I'm flunking your test here, Dr. Pearls, and I'm not very happy. I only get up to 81 on your test. So I think role models really do, I think, have some impact. Would you not agree, Dr. Banaji?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons that we want to bring to the public's awareness the notion that these stereotypes exist at some subtle or imperceptible level is so that we can then be aware of how pernicious they are and do something about it. And it just looks like what we currently see in Dr. Levy's study and I think in Dr. Pearls' studies are people who, for whatever reason that we don't know, decided to have this kind of positive outlook. They happen to be more extroverted, low on neuroticism, whatever that they did to say, look, I don't believe old people are helpless and so on. But what we'd like to do is to make this a much more routine part of the way in which we encourage everybody to think. Once we have studies like theirs, we can actually show them the data and say, look, it matters. And once you look at those correlations, you can now say, well, maybe we can make this into a cause and effect thing now that you can begin to do these things religiously, like you exercise for good health. Good thoughts are things that you might want to do as part of your daily practice.
Dr. Levy, quick last word. Has this changed the way you view your own aging?
Well, I'd like to think that I question the negative stereotypes more now that I've done this research. And I'd just also like to add, there are some global and national movements to try to improve views of aging, too. Like the United States Special Committee on Aging has started to address this, too, which is another legislative action is a great way to go, too.
Thank you very much. We've been talking about aging and how our perceptions of getting old can influence our own aging process. Dr. Thomas Pearls, Professor Becca Levy, Professor Mazarine Banaji, thank you all for joining us. Becca Levy is a professor at the Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Thomas Pearls is the director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center. And Mazarine Banaji is a professor of social psychology at Harvard University. Coming up, it's our regular Monday feature, Local Made Good. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Samit & Company Certified Public Accountants. Whether growing your business or securing your financial future, Samit is committed to strategic solutions for success today and into the future. SamitandCompany.com and from Safety Insurance, which is committed to working with independent agents in Massachusetts and New Hampshire to provide coverage that protects your homes, autos, business, and financial interests. You can learn more about Safety Insurance at SafetyInsurance.com.
This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station for depth and understanding.
For ideas and discussion.
With fresh air.
The world.
And all things considered.
Explore new voices with us all day long.
Here on the new 89.7 WGBH.
Sometimes the finer things in life really are just a click away. Visit auction.wgbh.org to preview what the WGBH Wine Auction is showcasing this year. Whether a collector or someone who just appreciates sharing a good bottle of wine, the WGBH Wine Auction has something for everyone. Bidding stops March 30th at auction.wgbh.org. Sponsored by Skinner Auctioneers and Appraisers.
This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station.
For trusted voices
and local conversation.
With fresh air.
And the Emily Rooney Show.
The new 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. It's time for our regular Monday feature, Local Made Good, where we celebrate people whose creativity and individuality bring honor to New England. And today we are joined by Glenn Lloyd. He is a community guy who runs City Fresh Foods Incorporated. It's a local catering business that prides itself on identifying local talent to promote quality business and community development. Now, Glenn Lloyd is the founder and chief executive officer. His brother, Sheldon, is the vice president of business development. Glenn is joining me here in the studio, and Sheldon's a little bit under the weather, but we're hoping to get him on the phone before our time is up. So, tell me how it all came together for you two, because you're quite the powerhouse now.
Well, we've been at it. It will be 16 years this year. So we started in a small little spot down in Dudley Street area, and I was actually teaching GD students. And one day looked around and said, you know what, how can we create our own jobs and our own wealth in our neighborhood? And that was the origins. And little did I know that 16 years later, I'd still be running this great community company.
Well, listeners, just to give you a sense of how big it's grown in those 16 years, you were once in a spot that was, 1,000 square feet, and now it's 11,000 or something? Tell me all about it.
We're excited to say we just moved. And, you know, we're in a manufacturing business at the end of the day, and we're making these really good quality meals every day. And you're bound by the four walls. So we just were able to get into the, I call it, ideal spot. And so we have some good space, some great light, and some more capacity to grow.
Now, the Lloyds are not chefs. They hire people who are chefs. They are business people that put the chefs to work. Okay. But I've been looking at your menus, and they're quite yummy, let me just say. One of the things that the Lloyds specialize in are your ability to do ethnic foods. Tell us about that.
Well, that's how we got into the business. We were probably the first in the nation to do the Latin to the elders in the neighborhood. These are folks who are used to, you know, their authentic food, and why not bring it to their homes when in their older age, and kind of, you know, following through your previous guests. And from that, we expanded to we actually do a Russian meal, we do an Italian menu, and even our traditional menu has a little Southern flavor to it.
And, yeah. I'm noticing this on this menu. First of all, I noticed that Jamaican beef patty kind of goes across several of your menus, and it made me very hungry. I was looking to see if you brought some. Listeners, he did not. I just want to point that out. Chipotle glazed beef, that's another one. Jack Daniel style barbecue ribs and rice and black beans are all across. I hear that we have Sheldon on the line. Sheldon, hello.
Hello.
Congratulations to you and your brother for the fabulous job that you're doing in an area that hires so many local people.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so since I have you on the line, before I keep drooling over these menus, I thought I would ask you about how it is that you two have come to hire so much local talent, because I know that a lot of your chefs came from right there in the neighborhood. So, Sheldon, why don't you weigh in on that?
Well, we get a lot of walk-in. You know, we've had people coming in, you know, and asking, you know, what we have. They smell the food coming outside the building. They see all the trucks coming out of the facility, and they see that big sunshine on the building. And folks have, walked through. And inner city, there's a lot of talent, and in the local neighborhoods, and to have a place that's manufacturing and making all these meals right there, they'd like to stay close to home.
Now, I understand that some of your employees have helped you to figure out what to prepare for all of your customers. Tell us about that.
Well, without a doubt, because as you said earlier, I can get busy in the kitchen when I have to, but
yeah, right.
Uh-huh. I'm not a trained.
You're looking like a businessman here.
not a trained chef, but you know. We have folks who are not, you know, they're trilingual, they come from different culture, and they know the different menu items that a lot of these folks are used to eating. So they bring a lot and add a lot to, rounding out our services.
Tell
us. We provide the environment for them to, you know, the canvas is there and they can paint on it.
There you go. I hear you have many ethnicities in your workers, Spanish, Cape Verdean, Creole, Brazilian, Haitian. You know, all of this is great.
all over the world. And let me tell you, it's like one big happy family. And sometimes, you know, as families go.
I understand.
But we figure it out. And, you know, some of the things is even the, just translation and language. And, you know, we have folks who are English as a second language. And so but, you know, at different parts of the company, sometimes you can get away because folks are, you know, communicating in their native tongue.
Who do you hire? How do you hire? And do the employees get opportunities inside to, you know, how do they move up, in other words, in your business?
Well, most of our managers are folks who have worked their way up through the company. So the gentleman running our kitchen, our logistics manager, used to be a driver and so on and so forth. So, you know, part of our philosophy is to keep growing. So we have more opportunities as we grow. We just actually reopened up our catering division. So we're now doing on-site catering and folks are able to, do more of that. Actually, a logistics manager, I have to say, he's a baker in his own home country, Cape Verde, and now is doing our pizza for us. So he actually comes in on the weekend and under his own kind of enterprise, doing about 8,000 pieces of pizza for us weekend.
So people you have employed have now gone on to do some businesses of their own addition to where you are.
That's correct.
Just to be clear, Sheldon, why don't you tell us all the places that you deliver and the people you deliver food to?
Well, we deliver to elders who are at home, and that's, you know, throughout greater Boston. And we deliver to charter schools in greater Boston mostly, but we also are going, as north as Salem. We're going out west as far as Westboro and south as far as Brockton right now. We do some residential programs, where people are there 7, days a week. And we do child care programs, and that's, throughout greater Boston as well.
Now, both of you brothers had businesses before you came together to build this one. You were doing something called Ginger Kids, Sheldon?
Yes.
I saved him from
Buffalo, New York.
Well, you know, it sounded interesting. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that was baking products for kids. It was a educational baking product, multicultural, because it dealt with baking products from other countries, like the baking mixes would come from other countries. So when you baked through the Ginger Kids, you opened up this package, and the package had a little bit about the language, a little bit about the culture.
Oh.
You were learning through baking. It was a gourmet product.
And your brother, Glenn, you were a landscaping business, right?
At the early age, yeah.
Tell us about that.
I was more the laborer.
I love that story.
Yeah. No, I think I was fifth or sixth. No, actually, yeah, elementary school. And I learned that you can, if you push a lawnmower, these are the old Sears, like the 21-inchers. And I figured out, wow, if I could hire some of my friends and charge them, pay them extra amount of dollars, I could actually make some money. And, by the time I graduated high school, we had a bunch of big John Deere lawn mowers, and we were doing a whole bunch of, lawns in the neighborhood.
Just to be clear, you started that business when you were 12 years old.
Was it 12? Yes, that's right. Something like that.
See, you've just moved on to it. I wish you would encourage some of these young people now to start a snow shoveling business right now. I'm in desperate need. That's just a plea for anyone who's 12 and listening to this. What's the best thing about owning this company and seeing the success that you have seen in that community?
You're creating jobs, which is kind of the number one issue in the neighborhood. And I just had a conversation with my younger worker, and he said, happens to have a quarry record. He said, there's not a lot of opportunities for us in the neighborhood. So to know that we can, we come to work every day. In addition to that, it's really, we're about a quality service and a quality product. So we're able to, when my grandmother was living, rest her soul, she was getting our food, and a lot of the kids we bring food to are the kids of our staff. So it's really getting a really healthy product out to the neighborhood.
Sheldon, what's the best thing you've heard, or one of the best things you've heard from people who have appreciated the business and being in the neighborhood, but also the product that you produce?
Well, I think it's customer service, and it's the quality of the product, and in a lot of cases we're servicing the underserved market. So you know, we treat, you know, our clients, you know, no matter who they are, like, you know, they're, you know, president or, you know, so they get, you know, a professional service and, you know, people say, wow, you know, and I think those are.
That's great. Where would you like to take the business next? I know bigger, but.
Yeah, bigger, more meals, you know, a name that's known, you know, for servicing the communities we service, you know, as we say, you know, employing in the community to serve the community. You know, and where even if somebody worked at City Fresh and they went somewhere else and they had that, you know, say they came from City Fresh, that they had a City Fresh standard, you know.
Fabulous. Well, how would you agree?
Glenn? I would agree. I think, you know, we're about economic development in our community. We're about quality product and service. And I think that, you know, City Fresh is a great platform to do a wide range of types of businesses.
How has it changed since your presence? How has the community changed since you've been there?
Well, we spent a lot of time in Four Corners, which is a great stint. And now we're back in Roxbury. We're back into the neighborhood we actually started in.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of very good people, you know, who are loyal, who are hardworking, and you know, there's not enough stories on that side of the equation,
right?
When folks mentioning our neighborhood, so you know, it's been steady. It's been a steady enjoyment working with the folks.
Okay, Sheldon.
You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, you know, we had in Four Corners. We were in the center of the corner, so you know, we had a. We kept our building there. It was always bustling. And, you know, Glenn and I were both involved in the community there on, you know, various organizations that helped the area develop. So, we've always been, you know, right at the ground floor.
Okay, I need to know from both of you. Sheldon, I'll start with you since you're a little bit under the weather. Your favorite food item of your many menus. I'm putting you on the spot.
I like the pollo casero, which is a stewed Caribbean, you know, Dominican style dish.
Okay, all right, and you, Glenn?
Oh, there's just so many.
Okay, well, name a few. Since you didn't bring any, might as well name some.
I hate to say this for the health folks, but we do a mean fried fish.
Okay,
and you know, and actually, you know, I hate to, you know, I'm a pizza guy, and I think our pizza is some of the best in Boston.
Okay, well, this has been a yummy conversation. Next time, brothers, I'd like to see some in the studio. But I'm just saying,
catch that, Sheldon.
Sheldon Lloyd and Glenn Lloyd of City Fresh Foods. Thank you so much for joining us for our local made good feature.
Thank you.
Learn more about City Fresh Foods, you can visit cityfreshfoods.com. You can keep on top of the Callie Crossley Show by visiting our website, wgbh.org/Callie Crossley. This is the Callie Crossley Show. Today's program was engineered by Jane Pippick and produced by Chelsea Mers. Our production assistant is Anna White Knuckleby. We are a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.